couple times a month, I'm meeting with some of our high school students here at the church. And each time we meet, we are exploring a different story from the Bible. We kind of started brainstorming all the stories we could think of from the Bible that they'd picked up through junior choir musicals or Sunday school or from wherever. VeggieTales movies often is where they pick them up. And then we talked about other ones, and we tried to discover which ones the kids weren't that familiar with, and then they chose the ones that they wanted to talk about in Bible study. So each time we get together, we're looking at a different story. Of course, all the stories they picked were in the Old Testament, because there's more stories in the Old Testament, and they're more obscure sometimes in the Old Testament. The hope is that the kids can get beyond the point of just learning the story to actually exploring what it might mean, having a little bit more critical thinking going into how we read the Bible and how we understand it. So all of that to say, this past week, we read the story of Cain and Abel. Now, as I was researching and thinking about it, the phrase that occurred to me, it's a preacher phrase that you wouldn't say to yourself, but those of us who are odd preachers say it, is we're researching and we're reading and we're thinking and we're praying, and we suddenly go, that'll preach. By which we mean there's something in this that is important, that we need to hear, that tells us the gospel story. And I think that the story of Cain and Abel is, in kind of a short microcosm cosmic way, the gospel story. Now, we're going to get to that in a little bit. So I want to summarize the story first, because I'm sure we know bits and pieces of it, but it's possible that it's not just the kids who weren't familiar with this story. It's not one that we talk about very often. I don't think that I have ever preached from the story of Cain and Abel. So essentially, where it starts is you have the two brothers, Cain and Abel. Cain is the older brother, Abel is the younger brother. These are the children of Adam and Eve. You find the story right at the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis chapter 4. We don't know anything about their growing up. We don't know anything about whether or not they got along. What we do know is one was a farmer and one was a shepherd. And one day, they went to take offerings, to make sacrifices to God. And so the shepherd brought a sheep, and the farmer brought some of what he farmed. And they brought it before God, and we don't know how they brought it. We don't know what they did with it. We don't know why they felt that they had to do it. All we know is they did. And then we know that God accepted Abel's offering. He accepted the shepherd's offering, and he didn't accept the farmer's offering. We don't know why he didn't accept it. We don't know how Cain knew that his offering wasn't accepted. We just know it wasn't accepted. And then what happened was that Cain got all mad about the fact that his offering wasn't accepted. But he didn't get mad at God. He got mad at his brother. And so he took his brother out into a field and killed him, because that's what brothers do. We even asked the question in our Bible study of whether or not Cain actually knew that Abel could die, because up until that point, no people had died in the Bible. So did he actually know that if he hit him in the rock with a rock, or we don't even know how he died, if we pushed him down a hole or something, did he know that he could actually die? We don't know any of that. We know that Cain killed Abel. And we know that then God confronted Cain and said, "What have you done?" Very similar to when Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit in the garden, and God showed up and he said, "What have you done?" And Adam and Eve, "Nothing, we didn't do anything." And Cain was kind of the same way, I think. "Oh, how do you know what I did?" Well, God's like, "Your brother's blood, which is spilt into the ground, is crying out to me for vengeance." The punishment on Cain is that no longer does he get to stay at home. He is kicked out of the only home that he's ever known. He's sent to be a nomad, a forager, a wanderer off in the wilderness. And from Cain's response, it sounds like he's sent away from God himself to be completely on his own. He turns to God and he says, "This punishment is way too harsh. If I go out there all on my own and you're not with me, I will be killed. I will be the victim of murder." Now, again, we don't know who are those people who were going to kill Cain if Cain and Abel, no longer Abel, and his mom and dad were the only people on earth. These are the questions that don't get answered in this story. But that's okay, as we're going to see. So God says to Cain, I'm going to put my mark on you to protect you. So you never have to worry that somebody is actually going to murder you. You will still be under my protection even as you are banished. That's, in summary version, the story of Cain and Abel. There's so many questions in that story. How did Cain know his offering wasn't accepted? Why didn't God accept Cain's offering? Did Cain and Abel have a history of animosity? Did they always fight when they were kids, or was this something new? Who did Cain expect would meet him and kill him if his brother, his mom, and his dad were the only people on the earth? There's so many questions in all of this. If we'd read one verse further, we get the really disturbing question that we talked about at length at Bible study, which tells us that Cain married someone. So that raises the question, who did Cain marry if these were the only people on the earth? Right? There's all sorts of questions that this story raises for us. If we approach this story like it's a historical narrative, like it's telling us the historic event from a particular point in time, then there's a lot missing. This is not a very good story as historical narratives go. There are far too many holes and gaps in it, far too many things that the reader is left wondering about. We can't even figure out what the point is because there's so many gaps and holes in it all. History is important because history teaches us things. When we look back at history, we learn things, especially when we look back at the mistakes of history, whether it's our mistakes, the history of humanity, the history of a nation, those mistakes should teach us things. Think about the phrase never again that's been so linked to the Holocaust, right? After the Holocaust, that phrase became very tied to it. Never again will we as a people be willing to stand by and see billions of people massacred. Never again. Now, here's the flaw in this idea that history teaches us things. Because clearly, if we look from World War II on, we have seen lots of instances where people have been massacred in the millions, the hundreds of thousands. Sadly, we can say never again in reference to the Holocaust, but we clearly didn't learn our lesson as a human race because we continue to do these things. But ideally, when we are educated about history, when we learn the historical stories, the historical narratives, they teach us things. They help us grow. They help us become better. The main Old Testament story that has shaped Jews since the beginning of Judaism, that has shaped Christians as well, is the story of the Exodus, the story our kids are learning downstairs today. The story of the people of Israel who were slaves in Egypt, who God rescued, and who Moses led out into the wilderness. He parted the waters and people walked through to safety to the other side. That story of the Exodus is the shaping pivotal moment in Israeli history. It's the moment that everything looks back to. It's the moment that teaches us and the Jewish people that God is a faithful God, that God comes through, that God is a Savior God. That's a story that's referred to in the Psalms and in lots of different places throughout the Bible. It's the historical narrative that shaped an entire nation. For us, for Christians, just a couple weeks past Easter, we know that the historical narrative that shapes us is the story of Jesus being crucified and of his resurrection. That historical narrative, that story out of history, shapes us and teaches us and lets us know what it is that God's about. It's really the same story as the Exodus story. It's the story that God is our Savior, that God is faithful, even when we are not. But what about Cain's story? Cain's story has far more holes in it than those stories that I just mentioned. How are we supposed to learn from stories that don't give us anywhere close to all the information that we need? If we read Cain's story, are we going to be any closer to understanding what an acceptable offering to God is? No. All we know is that there's some offerings that aren't acceptable. And we can be in trembling and fear if we look at this as simply a historical narrative. Maybe this story doesn't include all those things it doesn't include, because maybe those things aren't the point of this story. So often when we, especially in those Old Testament stories, especially in those kind of primeval stories from the beginning of Genesis, we get all caught up in the facts. It had to happen this way and this way and this way. And then we work all sorts of ways to try and figure out how to make it fit. You know, how do we make the creation stories fit with the knowledge that we have of dinosaurs when they aren't mentioned in the creation stories? How do we make the story of Cain and Abel and Adam and Eve fit when there weren't apparently anybody else on the earth, but Cain got married? What do we do with that? So we wrap ourselves into knots trying to solve the problems of the gaps and of what's missing. But I think we do a disservice to the story and to Scripture itself when that's our focus. Because if those things aren't in there, it's because they're not meant to be in there. It's because they're not the important point. They're not the focus. Maybe this story is not about the offering. Maybe it's not about the relationship between brothers. Maybe it's not a story to tell us what the population of the earth was long, long ago. Maybe this is a story about the human condition in general. Maybe Cain is a metaphor for all human beings. Maybe Cain is all of us. When we stop insisting that this is an event that occurred at a certain point in history, here it is, and just look at it for information as a historical narrative, we're freed up to recognize that the stories carry far more truth in them than just the events of a past time and a past place. Maybe this story isn't really just about Cain. Maybe this is a story that's actually about all of us, about the human condition. So what does this story tell us about the human condition? This is the verse that grabbed me when I was reading it. It's in Genesis 4:7. It's not even the whole verse. It reads, "Sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you." There's Cain. He has murdered his brother. He is standing in the field over his brother, away from his brother. We don't know what's going on. And God approaches him and says, "What have you done? Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground." And then he says to Cain, "Beware, because sin is lurking at the door and its desire is for you." Gives us the image of this kind of monster waiting, standing close by, ready to devour, ready to consume, ready to destroy. Beware, Cain. Sin is lurking at the door and it wants to destroy you. It wants to devour you. This is the same warning that God could have given Judas. It's the same warning that God could have given Peter before he denied knowing Jesus. I think what happened was that God looked at Cain and God saw that Cain was filled with bitterness and with anger and with hatred. And he saw those all as the doors through which sin could enter and devour. I think that Judas was so filled with disappointment in Jesus and what he'd expected that didn't come through. That sin, that was the door that sin was able to use to enter in and devour Judas. I think Peter was so filled with fear that fear became a door through which sin was able to enter. The lurking sin was able to enter and destroy and devour. See, we talk about sin as Christians. But what I like about this story is that it makes sin this thing that is out to get us. And I don't want us to all walk away all paranoid, and as we continue in the story, we'll realize we don't have to. But let's be honest that sin is a reality. Jesus wouldn't have been crucified if sin wasn't a reality. All the mess our world is in wouldn't be a reality if, wouldn't be here if sin wasn't a reality for us. Sin is lurking at the door, and its desire is for you. Its desire is for me. Sin is the opposite of God. God who is good and just and faithful. God who is love. Sin's only power is to destroy. That's all it wants, to destroy us. I remember long ago in my life, in a time I try and forget, when I quite enjoyed going out to pubs and partying a lot and being involved in all the things that are involved in those things, which some of you are familiar with and some of you aren't, and that's great. I remember saying, I don't want to go to heaven where everybody's just going to be sitting on clouds playing harps and stuff. Like, what fun does that seem like? I remember saying to people, I would rather go where the party is. I would rather actually find myself where the rock music, the sex and the drugs and all the rest of it is going to be. Because that sounds like a heck of a lot more fun than sitting on clouds playing harps. Now, my understanding of what heaven was clearly wrong. My understanding of what hell was clearly wrong. But the point is, I think, that we have this image that all the great things in life, that sin contributes to all the great things in life. But the truth is that sin's only desire is to destroy us, is to devour us from the inside out, is to pull us apart and wreck us completely. God's power is to create, to build up. God's Spirit gets in us and transforms us, turns us into creatures of beauty and holiness and goodness. Some of us may find ourselves sitting in heaven playing in harps, but if that's not what God has gifted you for, I'm pretty sure you won't have to sit up in heaven and play a harp. Heaven is being surrounded by all that is good and holy, all that is just, and all that is joy and peace, all that sense of things being right with the world, with nothing anywhere that can destroy us or devour us or wreck us. That's what God is compared to what sin is. Sin, which is lurking at the door. And we all have different doorways that allow that sin to come in and devour us. For Cain, I think it was his bitterness. I think that was the big thing. He was so bitter that his offering wasn't accepted when Abel's was. It's fascinating to me that it wasn't God he got angry at. It was his brother he got angry at. Like if he could just knock out the competition, maybe he'd be better in God's estimation. For Judas, I'm sure he was so disappointed in all the hopes and dreams he had held. And when Jesus didn't live up to them, his disappointment opened up a door for sin to walk through and devour him. Peter was so afraid of finding himself on trial with Jesus, on a cross next to Jesus, that sin was permitted entry to devour him and destroy him. But here's the good news in all of that. The good news is that God has mercy. That God protects Cain even when he has opened up and allowed sin to come in and devour him. He protects him from being completely annihilated. He says to him, I will put my mark on you so that no one can murder you. Yep, here are the consequences of the choices you made, the life that you have. You're a nomad, you're a wanderer, you're away from home. But I will still protect you. Isn't that the gospel? Peter, in his fear, opens up the door and sin works its way in and he denies knowing Jesus. It wrecks him. And then later on, he encounters Jesus. In a few weeks, we're going to be looking at this story when he encounters Jesus. And he experiences Jesus' forgiveness. The mercy works in there because God is a merciful God. Eventually, Cain marries. Cain settles down somewhere. Cain has children. Cain is the first one that we know of who built a city. Cain is not lost, consumed, and destroyed by sin because God has mercy on him. And so despite where his life went wrong, he's still able to have a life and have a life that matters and has meaning. This is the gospel story shrunk down into one man's life. Sin is lurking at the door and its desire is for you. But even when sin gets in, Even when sin gets its way, God intervenes and he saves us. Isn't that extraordinary? It's not God who said, hey, I'm going to do all sorts of things so that you'll want to let sin in. It's not God's fault that we get consumed by all these things that allow us to open up the doors and let sin come in to wreck us. But God steps in. He has such compassion for us. He steps in and he saves us. He intervenes. That's the story of Jesus on the cross. Humanity is wrecked. And God steps in the person of Jesus and saves us by dying on the cross for us. Sin got its way, but then God intervened. He raised Jesus from the dead and he saved it. Sin got its way for a little while, but not for the long term. That's the gospel. Yes, sin wants to have its way with us. And yes, there's things that we can do to prohibit sin from walking into our lives, from entering into the doorway of our lives and wrecking us. But even when we have allowed sin in, even when we are being consumed, devoured, and destroyed by sin, God is there to intervene, to save us, to protect us, to love us back to wholeness.